from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Penny Nelson. Coming up on Forum, a discussion about medical marijuana and the research going on or not going on around its benefits, safety, and efficacy. Despite growing bipartisan support for the availability of certain strains of pot that seem helpful in managing epilepsy, there's remarkably little federally approved research around cannabis, and the research that is approved hits roadblocks that slow down studies. Some universities steer clear of pot-related research altogether, nervous that such work will put their federal funding at risk. This hour, we consider the state of research around this politically charged plant that may be legal as medicine in many states, but still lacks federal approval. That's all ahead on Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson. Why is there so little research studying the medical benefits and safety of marijuana? It's legal for medicinal purposes in 23 states, with patients saying they find it helpful as they battle a myriad of conditions, including arthritis, epilepsy, PTSD, and cancer. The use of one of the plant's compounds, CPD, for children with epilepsy has been in the news quite a bit this summer after showing dramatic effects reducing seizures in kids. The response has been so strong that there are bipartisan supporters in Congress now for a bill introduced by Pennsylvania Republican Scott Perry that would exclude therapeutic hemp and cannabidiol from the definition of marijuana under the Controlled Substances Act, even though those are derived from pot. But marijuana is still a Schedule I drug, the most restrictive of five groups, and drugs in this category are not thought to have any accepted medical use in the U.S. They are seen as highly addictive, and scientific study around them is subject to tight restrictions. Marijuana remains Schedule I due to insufficient evidence that it works and is safe. But here's the catch. Because of the politics around pot, concern about abuse, and the paucity of evidence, there seem to be significant hurdles to conducting such research. Scientists and universities may feel they put their funding at risk if they pursue such studies, and as a result, the peer-reviewed and replicable studies needed to gain approval aren't happening in sufficient numbers. That's the topic for today's Forum program, and with us for the hour to talk about it are four guests. We have Dr. Tim Saramack with us. He's the president of the California Society of Addiction Medicine, past president, I should say, and a psychiatrist specializing in addiction psychiatry. Good morning, Tim. You with us? And we've got Tamer Todd. She's director of marijuana law and policy at the Drug Policy Alliance. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Sue Sisley, Dr. Sue Sisley. She's assistant professor of internal medicine and psychiatry at University of Arizona, Arizona's College of Medicine. And also with us, Igor Grant, professor and chair of the Department of Psychiatry at UC San Diego School of Medicine, and also the director of UC's Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
And I do want to say that we invited both the Drug Enforcement Administration representatives or somebody from the National Institute on Drug Abuse to join us for the hour, but they did not make anyone available. So since we will be discussing this as sort of part of a governmental process in funding, that's unfortunate. We would love to have their voices, but we just don't have anybody here from there, even though we did invite them. And I hear Dr. Tim Saramack, you're with us now?
I am. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for joining us this morning. Well, Dr. Sue Sisley, I want to start with you. You're a professor at Arizona College of Medicine, and we're involved and have been working towards a research endeavor on medical marijuana at that place until you lost your job this summer. I want to use yours as sort of a case study for what academic researchers are facing when they're trying to do research on the cannabis plant.
Yeah, well, it is a fascinating case study because, the problem is these public institutions are controlled by legislators who often don't support this type of research, who, you know, many of our electeds, our legislators in Arizona, have gone on record to say that they oppose marijuana research because they believe it is simply a strategy to promote marijuana legalization. They believe that, you know, somehow these researchers are going to thwart the data to miraculously make marijuana look good, and that data will be used later in some type of ballot initiative to promote full adult legalization. So it's really problematic when legislators, you know, value, you know, when they're not willing to value science, and they allow science to be trumped by politics in this way. And these are the same legislators who control university budgets. So you can see how university presidents are fearful about tangling with this work, and they'll have, you know, defending that work when so many legislators are opposed to it.
Are there certain spots that are bottlenecks? So you're talking about the state lawmakers, but my understanding is that research is at several times, many times, federally approved. Yours made it through several hoops and then got bottlenecked at one particular spot. So I know it started in 2010 for you, this project, and now you have been fired and your project is not going on, at least under your supervision. Walk us through a little bit some of the big hallmark steps that brought you to where you are now.
Yeah, well, I'd say the biggest hurdle was probably this Public Health Service review. The PHS review is sort of a redundant additional review after you've already received FDA approval. And nobody really understands why it exists, because no other Schedule I drug is subject to this second redundant review by Public Health Service.
Who implemented that?
I believe that was the Controlled Substances Act about 20 years ago, where they created this Public Health Service review and the NIDA monopoly, NIDA being the only legal source of marijuana for any FDA-approved trials. So these additional reviews, the problem with them is they have no timeline to respond. So when you send something to the FDA, at least they're on a 30-day timetable. But with Public Health Service and NIDA, there's no such timetable. So they can take 10 years to respond to an inquiry, and that's how these things get stonewalled.
And NIDA, just to clarify, is the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And that's one of the organizations we invited a representative to be here from, but that didn't happen. So there's another big, interesting hurdle that is facing people interested in medical marijuana research, and that's that there is one approved source for the marijuana plant that any research around the U.S. can use, and that's one particular farm in Mississippi. And all the plants that are going to be used in medical marijuana research approved by the U.S. have to come from that one farm. Why is that the case, and how did that affect your particular project?
Well, yeah, they've been granted this monopoly through the DEA, and it doesn't make it's completely indefensible. I mean, any other Schedule I drug, you can purchase study drug from a variety of different labs. But marijuana, yeah, there's only one legal supply. And the problem is that if NIDA doesn't like your study, they can simply refuse to sell you study drug even after you've received FDA approval and IRB approval, and that will effectively shut down your study without being able to purchase this drug. So the other problem is that, you know, NIDA has a requirement through the law that they must provide a continuous and uninterrupted supply of marijuana for all these FDA-approved studies, and they've already failed to do that. Our study, you know, finally, you know, hurdled the final federal obstacle back in March of this year, and in March, the NIDA had to admit to us that they had no study drug to sell us. So even though after we received FDA approval back in 2011, NIDA insisted that they had all the marijuana study drug to sell us for our protocol. In fact, they did not have it, and they won a court case against MAPS by claiming that they had it. MAPS is my sponsor, a nonprofit that's been sponsoring this research from the beginning. And
you were not allowed to go outside of the U.S. to get your plants?
No, we're not allowed. That's the only legal supply. And so what's concerning is, so since March, we've had the ability to embark on this study, but NIDA has been unable to provide the study drug, even though they're required by law to provide a continuous and uninterrupted supply. Now they're saying that they may have study drug for us available in January of next year. But we don't know. They're supposedly growing a crop for us right now. If that crop is successful, maybe we'll have study drug. You know, but it's just disheartening because there's so many expert growers. The potential for all kinds of plant biology experts around the country to weigh in on this process and make study drug available from a variety of different sources. And many of them have petitioned the federal government requesting the ability to do that, but all those petitions have been denied.
All right. Well, that and your story is really well laid out in a New York Times article of August 9th for folks who want to read more about the particulars of Sue Sisley's research being stymied and sort of shut down for now. I want to go to Dr. Igor Grant, who is at UC San Diego, and get you to weigh in on this NIDA issue. You have 13 of the 19 projects that the federal government has greenlighted since 1999. So you clearly are one of the key spots in the U.S. for this research. What's your experience been in just the overall granting process and then getting the plants that you need?
Sure. Thanks. We may be in a bit of an unusual position. Just by way of brief history, the legislature and the governor approved the establishment of a Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research at the University of California, back in 2000. And the idea was to do some clinical trials and some preclinical studies on efficacy. Then Senator John Vasconcellos was actually at the forefront of this effort. So we've actually completed 7 clinical studies, and then there are some preclinical and others.
Are those phase wise? Because I know to get the approval, it has to go through the animal phase, the human phase. Where are you?
No, well, these were clinical studies. We did a little bit of animal work, but this was not the usual process. You have to do your animal studies first, and then the human studies. We can go into the reasons later, but the point is that the process, just to speak to that, was that we had funding from the state of California to support these studies. Our process was we asked investigators in California to submit their proposals to us. They were reviewed by a national panel of scientists, and then those that we thought were worthy were then forwarded as a recommendation to the federal government. The federal government, as Dr. Sisley points out, has a number of steps of approval that involve different agencies, including FDA, DEA, which is the Drug Enforcement Administration, and the Health and Human Services group. Once they reviewed, they sometimes had additional recommendations for modification, but ultimately we had the 7 studies approved and received the marijuana. The process is time-consuming, as was pointed out, but we did not experience actual obstacles. That is, we had to meet with federal officials, explain what we were doing, and so on and so forth. But I think after a certain level of understanding and trust was gained, the process was, as I say, time-consuming, but not, I didn't feel we were blocked at any point. Having said that, I think that an ordinary investigator, say if I was just come as an investigator from the university, not part of a center, saying I want to do some clinical medical marijuana research, I think it would be difficult just because of all the many regulatory hurdles and steps.
And what about the idea that part of this part of moving it out of Schedule 1 and into Schedule 2, or making it more available as a drug that can be investigated, is that the studies that are done have to be replicable, have to be reproducible. But if you're the main center for a lot of this research, how are your peers, how are folks in other states or in Minnesota and Baltimore, wherever, how are they going to be able to replicate your study if they are not as likely to be able to get through the hoops or get access to the plants?
Well, I think one needs an organization with adequate administrative and other kinds of expertise to navigate the system. But, for example, there's no reason that the state of Colorado, which actually has now part of their tax funds on marijuana set aside for medical research, there'd be no reason they couldn't do what the UC Center did, develop protocols for studies, work with the federal government, and implement their own work. It is true that at the moment the marijuana has to come from the University of Mississippi source. It's the only legal source in the U.S. So that could be a potential bottleneck if, let's say, 50 studies suddenly came down or something like that. I expect they'd have trouble keeping up.
Can private research interests or endeavors use plants that are not coming? Is it legal for, say, a private interest to do research on this on a large scale and not use plants from Mississippi?
I'm not a legal expert. My understanding, though, that it is not legal to use for human clinical trials anything except the NIDA procured marijuana. But, as I say, I'm not a lawyer, but that is my understanding.
This reminds me of the whole issue around stem cell research and embryos and how there was this bottleneck created around doing stem cell research, that the approval had to be based on where one would get one's embryos. And it's just an interesting sort of parallel. Dr. Tim Saramek, I want to go to you. Let's just start with what the drawbacks to moving forward with this kind of research are. Like, what are the concerns that when abuse and NIDA are NIDA, which is an institute that studies drug abuse, other drugs are abused, alcohol is abused, opiates are abused. Why does marijuana have so much more of a restriction around it and the fear of abuse?
Well, it's simply historical and political and cultural. There isn't any scientific reason for any of that. It was tied into a tremendous amount of ethnic prejudice at the time that the marijuana was made illegal. That has gotten so ingrained in the politics that politicians for a long time have been in a position where to say anything that would be more liberal in terms of what to do regarding the research on this would be seen as soft on drugs, and that you could easily be attacked. So the politics has vastly distorted the entire issue. If we step back and take a much longer view on this, the issue is not really about marijuana at all in terms of the science. Marijuana is a little bit like foxglove used to be. Foxglove is a flower that people used to make into a tea if they had heart failure. And it couldn't be very well dosed because you didn't know how much to use. But science found the elements in that, the digitalis that was in that, and improved it into better and better medications. And we're at the stage now with marijuana that we were when we only had foxglove in the beginning. The future is moving in a direction that will have little or nothing to do with marijuana, and it will have everything to do with the natural cannabinoid system that operates in the brain, and which is part of the normal brain chemistry. I've heard you say several things about NIDA. I'd like to point out one person, Elliot Gardner, who used to be the chief of the neuropsychopharmacology at NIDA. He has a marvelous slide which shows 50 different illnesses that he says there are already good evidence showing that our natural cannabinoid system is involved in those illnesses, and that we can modify those illnesses by modifying the activity of our natural cannabinoid system. Marijuana is just one very small way of doing that. And in the future, we will find chemicals that are related to THC, that are related to CBD, but that are much more targeted, much safer, far fewer side effects. So we're just in the very, very early stages. And we have to be grateful to marijuana for having introduced us to the chemistry in that plant that then we were able to see simply mimics of very important chemistry that exists in all of our brains.
Let me stop you. I'm not sure I understand what natural cannabinoid system is. Is that the whole genus of plants? Is that what is the natural cannabinoid system?
See, that's really amazes me that information has not gotten into the general knowledge. Everyone knows about an endorphin high. It's just part of the common parlance to talk about an endorphin high. And all that means is that we have a chemistry in our brain which is similar to the opiates, to morphine and other opiates. And the only reason that opiates work is because they mimic our endorphin chemistry. Well, we have an endogenous or a natural in the brain cannabinoid chemistry, which is so large that it dwarfs our endorphin chemistry. It's pervasive through the brain, and there's a chemistry there which is so close to the chemistry that we see in THC and CBD that our brain can't tell the difference.
So our brain can mimic the chemistry or can mimic the effects of what the cannabis plant is offering?
I would put it the other way around. I would say that the cannabis plant has chemistry that mimics our natural chemistry.
All right.
And our brain can't tell the difference.
Oh, that's so interesting. Okay, and here this, I did not know that, and obviously I'm sure lots of folks out there don't. We're talking this hour about medical marijuana. It's legal in 23 states, but has still not been federally approved as an effective medicine. And that's because there's just not enough research to support the approval. And the question is, with so much support, why is not more research going on into the medical safety, efficacy, and benefits of medical marijuana? Just speaking was Dr. Tim Saramack, past president of the California Society of Addiction Medicine. Is that right? Am I right there?
Yes.
Past president? Okay.
Yes.
And we also were hearing from Dr. Igor Grant from UC San Diego's Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research and Dr. Sue Sisley from Arizona College of Medicine, a woman who was deep into a research project with medical marijuana, and it was cut short, or let's just say it got very political, and she was also fired, perhaps in part around that work. And we will be talking also with Tom Artaud, director of the Marijuana Law and Policy Director at the Drug Policy Alliance. And if you'd like to join in the conversation, the number to do so is 866-733-6786. We especially would love to hear from people who have either felt the benefits of medical marijuana but had their doctors perhaps rebuff them, and also anybody that's involved in medical research, in research at all, that might use these plants and has been stymied in their own efforts. So give us a call, 866-733-6786, or if you're just interested in the topic and want to weigh in or ask a question as well. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. We're going to be back after a short break. We're also going to talk about a bill that's in front of Congress that is looking to exempt certain aspects of pot from the medical marijuana laws, and talk also about how we can maybe get this ball rolling and see if, as we were just hearing, we might be in the early stages of research, but maybe there's a way to get it going a little quicker, since it sounds like it's a cultural, political, and historical thing that's holding us up in this kind of research. I'm Penny Nelson. This is Forum, and we'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, and we're talking this hour about medical marijuana and the politics around research into medical marijuana's potential, funding issues, who can do it, and also all the hoops that must be jumped through in order for researchers to carry out significant research. With us for the hour is Dr. Tim Saramack, past president of the California Society of Addiction Medicine, also Dr. Igor Grant, professor and chair of the Department of Psychiatry at UC San Diego Diego School of Medicine and also the director of UC Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research, and Dr. Sue Sisley, assistant professor of internal medicine and psychiatry at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. Also with us, Tamar Todd, the director of marijuana law and policy at the Drug Policy Alliance. And Tamar, I want to go to you and talk about sort of the politics of Schedule One and how that might change. But before we do that, I would like to hear from one of the representatives, Republican representatives, that is pursuing changes in medical marijuana legalization. It's U.S. Representative Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, a Republican, and he's among those calling for these changes governing medical marijuana. He appeared on CNN earlier this month, I think it was August 11th, talking to Dr. Sanjay Gupta. Let's hear from him.
If you would have asked me 5 years ago, 3 years ago, hey, you know, you're going to be the champion for CBD, for medical marijuana, I'd have said you're probably crazy. I've never been for recreational drug use or extracurricular drug use. But I will tell you, I really didn't think about, you know, whether it's politically viable, if this problematic for me. I looked at these families. I said, this is my job. I ran for this office. We have a duty. The federal government is standing in the way of their treatment. We need to break down this barrier and allow them to treat their children, keep their family together. So in a way, I think that's why my staff kind of looked at me like, are you crazy? But I feel like this is important and we need to be doing this.
And once again, that's U.S. Representative Scott Perry, a Republican from Pennsylvania, who is among several who are calling for changes to the federal law governing medical marijuana. And he's referring to cases where epilepsy, I think it's called the Charlotte's Web medicinal marijuana law, where they would exclude therapeutic hemp and cannabidiol from the definition of marijuana under the Controlled Substances Act, because they're finding that a compound, CBD, derived from marijuana is extremely effective in calming seizures in epileptic children, and parents are wrestling with how to get a hold of this CBD to treat their children, and hitting obstructions along the way and doing that. So he is calling for changes, as are some others, both Democrat and Republican, in Congress. And Tamar Todd, let's go to you, Director of Marijuana Law and Policy at the Drug Policy Alliance. Legally, what can be done to make some changes?
Okay, well, there's a number of things that can be done, and as you point out, the issue of Charlotte's Web and CBD is, I think, changing the political situation in a rapid fashion, because we have a group of very visible and very vocal children who are suffering from a very severe form of epilepsy, who are demonstrating that they're getting beneficial help from this compounded marijuana in Colorado. Families are moving to Colorado, calling themselves marijuana refugees. Other families are being torn apart, with one parent going to Colorado and one having to stay in New York. And legislators are starting to pay attention in states. 10 states rapidly passed CBD-only laws. Whether they'll actually be legally implementable is an open question, and Congress is paying attention to, and we're seeing some more support. But actually, I think the support in Congress, the tide is turning on marijuana in a broader way than just focus solely on the CBD, and we're seeing bipartisan support from a broad group of legislators on broader marijuana policy reform issues. Just for example, the House has voted 5 times in recent months on marijuana, not on the CBD legislation, but twice on hemp, twice to allow banking services for medical marijuana businesses and medical marijuana states that are legal under state law, and actually businesses in Washington, Colorado as well, and once to prevent federal raids and federal interference with state marijuana programs. We've also seen in the Senate, we saw bipartisan legislation from Cory Booker and Rand Paul. So we're seeing more movement quicker than we ever have before, and the tide sort of turning on that in a broad way. As Tim pointed out, you know, the issue of marijuana has always been very political, and I just wanted to say one thing about the NIDA monopoly on source and the additional hurdles provided to marijuana research that don't exist for other Schedule I drugs. Those are not set forth in the Controlled Substances Law or mandated by federal law. They are instituted by the Drug Enforcement Administration, largely due to its attitudes towards marijuana and marijuana research. And just this past, a couple months ago in June, 30 members of Congress wrote a letter to the Department of Health and Human Services and the agencies asking for some of the barriers to be removed and to be eased, because there's no reason why those restrictions need to be in place. And there's other countries. The UK provides more than a single source of marijuana for research.
And we have a letter here from the Office of the Assistant Attorney General, Peter Kadzik, and it does say here that in the letter, Congress, of course, possesses the authority to change the scheduling of or to remove from the CSA marijuana or any controlled substance without regard to medical or scientific evidence. However, we don't believe doing so would be in the public interest. So this is political. Congress could do it?
Well, it's political both in Congress and the agency and by the administrative. Because there's two, I mean, getting back to your question about what they can do about the schedule, there's two ways that substances can be either added to the schedules, removed from the schedules, or moved to a different schedule, so from Schedule 1 to a lower schedule. Congress can do it by amending the Controlled Substances Act, but it can also happen administratively, and that authority is given to the Attorney General in the Controlled Substances Act, and he has delegated that power to the Drug Enforcement Administration. So it could happen completely administratively through the agency, initiated either on the agency's own accord, by the executive, or by a petition of an interested party. And over the years, there's been a number of interested parties who seek to reschedule and have filed petitions that have been met with long delays. The last one was rejected in 2011 after an 8-year delay. And there's currently a petition pending to reschedule that was filed by former Governor Christie of Washington and Governor Chafee of Rhode Island, asking the DEA to reschedule marijuana so that their states can move forward with medical marijuana without sort of interference, and so that research can move forward that would benefit, the residents of their state who are using it.
Let's go to some of the calls. We've got a full bank here. David is calling us from Fremont. Good morning, David.
How you doing?
Good.
One of the things I wanted to bring up seems missing here is the elephant in the room of American drug policy, specifically institutional racism. Recently we had, earlier reported on the state legislator passing the bill to Governor Brown about crack cocaine being the one-to-one sentencing. Federally, it was recently changed from 101, the incredibly racist 100-to-1 sentencing disparity, to the still really racist 18-to-1, and that was considered a victory.
Right. Thank you for raising that point. That's as we have seen. That's clearly part of the package. Tamar Todd, what do you notice politically on that front?
I think the caller brings up an excellent point that the issue about marijuana, the politics around marijuana, is tied certainly and directly to the larger politics about the war on drugs, which has racial underpinnings. In terms of marijuana law enforcement more generally, it's enforced across the country in an extreme racially disparate manner. We've existed for a long time in an era of prohibition where some people can basically obtain and use marijuana freely as they do alcohol, but other people, largely young men of color living in cities that are heavily policed, are arrested and saddled with drug law convictions that have lifelong collateral consequences that affect their ability to get housing, employment,
and that are also very expensive for the state as well. We have a website comment directly to that with one of our listeners writing, with marijuana, making it illegal in the 1930s came about not because we suddenly found out it was dangerous, but because it provided a job program for all those federals displaced by rescinding prohibition, and as part of the South's permanent campaign to keep blacks as subjugated as they were during slavery, marijuana was presented as something Negroes took that made them act like wild animals that good white Americans had to protect themselves from. So that's a comment from the website. And
it is important to realize that if you look at the amount of use, that both among adults and among adolescents, whites use it more than blacks or Hispanics.
Sure, sure. Let's go to another call. We've got Bon calling us from Milpitas. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. You know, this whole thing here, one of your prior caller pointed out, of course, that this never was illegal until the repeal of Prohibition, and all the cronies in Washington didn't want to lay their friends off, so they made marijuana and drugs illegal.
All right. Thanks for the input. Thank you, Bon. And going now to Catherine in San Anselmo. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I am a 20-year chronic pain patient, and I'm my doctor has been sympathetic with regard to giving me a marijuana card so that I could purchase it. I'm really interested in tincture, not in smoking. And she's denied me that because she's afraid of losing federal funding. I take a very low dose of morphine two times a day, and if I did not take it, I could not leave my house. As I said, I've been a chronic pain patient for 20 years, and I'd really like an alternative to morphine.
Dr. Grant, why don't you weigh in on that one?
Yeah, so one of the types of uses for medicinal cannabis is the management of pain, and in particular, the best evidence is for a type of pain called neuropathic pain. This is a kind of burning, tingling, hypersensitivity that people get with some medical conditions like HIV, AIDS, diabetes, certain kinds of injuries, and so forth. And it's not actually that well controlled by traditional medicines such as, say, aspirin or ibuprofen or opioids even. And here, cannabis seems to have a very good effect. And also there's some evidence, though it's not uncontroversial, that the use of cannabinoids may have a sparing effect. That is, you may be able to use less opioid if you combine it with cannabis. So there could be that effect as well, getting people onto lower doses of opioids, which can have their own side effects that are quite problematic.
And it's interesting that just in the news, I think yesterday and today, is the fact that the federal government is offering or insisting on, I guess, amped up regulations around the use of opiates, or is that right? Vicodin and drugs like that, OxyContin, because of abuse. So there are plenty of drugs out there that are approved, that are abused, and that might be replaced by perhaps a milder or even possibly a less addictive product if there was the research to back up the substance?
Well, I'll just offer, this is just a personal opinion, that I think whenever we try to use legislative approaches to medical problems, there are often unintended consequences. So, for example, when government cracks down on heroin use, and yet pills that contain opioids are available, obviously people then migrate to using the pills. Right. There were instances where there was a crackdown years ago on marijuana, so people then migrated to use of some other drugs. I don't mean to say these are one-to-one relationships, but we always have to look at, addiction and the use of drugs as a medical problem, not only a problem of criminal justice and so forth. So there are often, as I say, these unintended consequences.
We're talking this hour about research around medical marijuana, and that was just Dr. Igor Grant speaking. Also with us, Tom R. Todd, Director of Marijuana Policy and Law at the Drug Policy Alliance. Also Dr. Tim Cermak, past president of the California Society for Addiction Medicine, and Dr. Sue Sisley from University of Arizona College of Medicine. And I want to emphasize that we invited both the National Institute on Drug Abuse, that's the NIDA that we keep referring to, and the Drug Enforcement Administration to join us for the hour, but they did not make anyone available. And I'm feeling slightly one-sided here because I feel like we don't have the voice saying, justifying the reasons for the process being what it is. If you are out there and you have some connection to that or feel a strong opposition to research around medical marijuana, certainly call in. We would love to hear some other points of view around this. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Once again, 866-733-6786, or email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website at kqed.org/forum. And again, we invited the other voices to be on the show, but they declined. So let's go back to some of our calls. We have got, I think it's Charlie now. Charlie, did I lost you before, didn't I?
Yes, I'm a primary care physician. I've seen many hundreds of patients with CTSD. I think this lady in Arizona was going to do a research study. Well, I'll tell her the research study will show that it definitely helps CTSD.
Wait, you're talking about PTSD, right?
I am against recreational use of cannabis for one good reason. I had a patient about a year ago. Oh, it was longer than that, 2 years ago. He came in, he's 42 years old, lost his appetite, thought he would try cannabis off the street and kind of helped him. And then he saw me a year later with his loss of appetite. He wanted to get legal. I went through the review of systems, et cetera, history, and found out he had cancer in his stomach. So that's what you call self-medication with cannabis. And I think it should be medically prescribed, but not recreational use. I think it's a big mistake.
All right. Well, thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Dr. Charlie, for calling in.
Welcome.
And let's hear from Stephen calling from Hayward. Good morning.
Good morning. I had some questions that I was hoping your panel can weigh in on. I've heard some statistics, and I just want to see how scientific they were. One comment was about the effects of cannabis psychologically. I personally know that it can cause a hyperfocus. I don't know if that's something that we've researched or some kind of a concentration thing. And I've also heard the statistic that you'd have to consume a third of your body weight in order to actually overdose, so to speak, on cannabis. Any comments to anything like that?
Who wants to take that? Dr. Grant, you've got the most research going at the moment.
Well, in terms of the sort of psychological or mental effects of acute cannabis use, that is, when you're actually using it as opposed to long-term effects, the typical effect, as I'm sure your audience will know, is that there's actually kind of a state of relaxation for most people. There's a subjective feeling of high, obviously. There can be problems with attention and memory and in complex movements, reaction time, things like that. Some people, not many, but some experience severe anxiety and even paranoid reactions or see visions, things like that. But these are less common problems. I am not aware of research that marijuana increases focus or concentration, but that's not to say for some individuals or some subgroup of people that might occur, particularly people who are anxious, and marijuana has an anxiety-reducing effect, I suppose. So as far as the toxicity of marijuana, I'm not aware of documented cases of people killing themselves with marijuana, just with marijuana. Now, marijuana, you do see overdose deaths where marijuana is implicated as one of many chemicals that somebody has ingested, but it's usually opioids or sleeping pills or things of that nature that are the actual toxic products. So it's possible marijuana could amplify that effect, but it per se is fairly non-toxic. I guess if you took enough of anything, you could kill yourself. But
it would
be very hard.
Yeah, and there's a listener writing in, actually, that counters that, saying it's horrendous that the medical community is still under the pall of silence to denounce the brutal effects of marijuana on the brains of growing children and how it's detrimental to the growth of neurons, especially on the new cortex. Please discuss the research done by Duke and in New Zealand about the toxic effects of marijuana. So
this is Igor Grant. I can comment briefly on that, and perhaps other panelists would like to. I think it's very interesting that studies can be, their results can be really, in a way, hyped and amplified way beyond the data. The New Zealand study is an interesting case in point. It looked at groups of adolescents who had various amounts of early marijuana use and then followed some of them up after a number of years. And what the study reported was that in a subgroup that had started early, heavier marijuana use and also had intermittent marijuana use, appeared to have a decline in IQ points years later. However, if you look at the study in detail, it involves, if I recall, something like 15 or 18, I mean, a very small number of cases that were compared after these years. I mean, under 20 cases in each of two groups. So, first of all, it's a very small sample size, and anything can happen with such small numbers. And secondly, there are, as was published by others, alternative explanations, which are that people who begin marijuana use early often have lots of other risk factors, social problems, sometimes learning problems. Sometimes they go to schools that don't encourage much learning. We, in fact, gain some IQ points over the years because those who people who get really enriched education, and those that don't may suffer some decline. So there are many explanations for these findings. Now, that is not to say that marijuana cannot affect the developing brains of children. I think that's entirely possible and likely, but the data are very weak right now.
All right. Another website comment has come in. The considerable resistance to medical marijuana and research into it makes perfect sense, though it is far from completely benign, as nothing in this amoral universe is. The laws against it are completely based on it being taboo, and a taboo in our somewhat enlightenment-derived world has a very hard time standing against the established fact of some obvious benefit. It's a Schedule I drug because to admit that it had any use and to its comparative safety compared to, say, methamphetamines or aspirin would erode the taboo. So that was a listener writing in on the website. I have a question. I kind of am locked in on this NIDA monopoly for some reason. My brain keeps going to that. And I'm just wondering, Tom or Todd, I'm going to take this to you. Whose interests are being served? Who benefits from the idea or from the reality that there is a bottleneck or that there is one source for the plant? Why is that the case?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I often get the question of what's motivating the DEA? Why is there this federal refusal to accept what most Americans know, and now a majority of state legislatures are saying that we know it has medicinal value. There's well over a million people using it in conjunction with their physician's advice. Why would we not have research on it? Why would we not move it forward? I think that it ultimately boils down to a very entrenched history, that Tim touched on, the origins of marijuana prohibition, the decision to place it, the decision about scheduling and about controls, not in a science-based, science-focused organization,
but
in a law enforcement organization.
But I somehow think there's money involved. I feel like either big pharmaceutical companies or somebody's got to be benefiting from the fact that
there isn't more
of a market out there.
Yeah, there is, and one of the pharmaceutical question, certainly I think at a point where it moves to become possible to develop medications, I think we'll certainly see money move in. One caller touched on one point that goes to more than research, but marijuana prohibition and the drug war generally, there is a lot of law enforcement money and, you know, careers and time and budgets invested in the continued prohibition of marijuana, the ability to perpetuate arrests, the ability to seize assets from people in many places that go to fund law enforcement directly. There's an institution there, you know, that has existed for many years whose focus and purpose is about, you know, controlling what we perceive as dangerous drugs.
Right.
And to change that threatens that history and that structure, I think.
All right, one last one.
If you create a bureaucracy, it's the National Institute of Drug Abuse. And this marijuana can be abused, and there are people who damage their lives with it. So that's their mission. Someone above them needs to say, okay, you've done your mission well, but there's other evidence. NIDA is not involved in medical research around illnesses. It's the National Institute of Drug Abuse.
All right, and we have to leave it there. We have to leave it there because, unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank you all for being with us this hour. Tom R. Todd is the director of the Marijuana Law and Policy section at the Drug Policy Alliance. Also hearing from Dr. Tim Saramack, past president of the California Society of Addiction Medicine, and Dr. Igor Grant, professor and chair of the Department of Psychiatry at UC San Diego's School of Medicine and also the director of UC's Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research. Also, we heard from Dr. Sue Sisley, assistant professor of internal medicine and psychiatry at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. And her story is documented in a New York Times article on August 9th. So if you want to hear the whole event that happened to her research, you can find it there. And thanks to all the callers who called in as well, of course. We'll stay with us for the second hour of the show. We'll be talking with best-selling food and culture writer Mark Kurlansky and his daughter, Talia, about international cooking. Forum's producers this week are Irene Noguchi, Vinnie Tong, Susan Britton, Suki Lewis, and Tina Larberg. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineers this hour are Danny Bringer and Rob Spate. For KQED, I'm Penny Nelson. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.